Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host...
New Earth Relic.
Kraken's staying annoying throughout the game because your ships are made of, like, tissue paper, so, like... They can one-shot each other, and the Krakens can still kill them pretty easily, too.
Look, they had to use really thin metal in order for it to be buoyant on the air quote water on the planet Fel. Come on now, what do you expect?
The air quote water.
Welcome to episode 224. I'm guest host New Earth Relic, and I'm joined by Dan Q.
Daring and never quitting.
Makalua.
Not quite adequately caffeinated enough yet.
The Mian Team.
Indeed.
And Madjin.
Okay.
I is also here.
Daring and never quitting, there's actually a reason why I chose those specific words. I'll even give you a hint and that specific order. If you can figure it out, I will take one of Mackie's internet cookies and give it to you.
Okay, thank you.
Don't forget the no prize.
That was blatantly obvious. Thank you.
Would you like to DNQ a few more times?
Thank you.
All right, imagine you are in the chat, and I didn't say couldn't go to a regular co-host, so there you go. I give you Mackie's internet cookie.
Hey, why are you giving away my internet cookies?
You don't need them.
Because you bake them so much better than I do, Mackie.
Okay.
Whew, that got me out of that situation. All right.
And let's jump into somebody else's situation. Apparently there was a patch, it went live for Beyond Earth. What would Geek Co-host say? Oh, yeah, it's garbage. Okay, the bad co-host will say that it came out, there's some changes, some good, some bad. Mostly, though, we did talk about it already, so it's a question of fan feedback. And, of course, finding all the little changes to things that you wouldn't know.
There is that very last entry from the patch notes, you know, miscellaneous changes. I'd like to see some of those documented by the community as people come across them as they play it. But as Madjin said, yeah, we talked about this patch extensively already. Episode 222, just over a month ago. It is version 1.0.2.658. So if you call up Beyond Earth and for some reason you're not running that version, you do not have the patch yet. You may have to restart Steam. Dave Hinkle, who is the community and social media manager for 2K Games, specifically for Firaxis, asks, give us your feedback. And then in the 2K thread specifically says, let's use this thread as a place for feedback on some of the changes so that we can gather all of that in one place for the devs. Thanks for playing. And then I thought, but you posted multiple threads in the community, so if you only want it in one place, then you shouldn't respond elsewhere than the 2K. I know, I'm trolling the wording big time, but you know, that's what I do.
Pedantic. Can't spell pedantic without Dan.
Thank you, Mackie. I was just about to point that out myself because, you know, that's how I am. So what was well received? It's a pretty short list.
What did people like?
Yeah.
But why don't we start with the positive, you know, which was auto renewal of trade routes.
Yay.
Thank you. Oh, my God. Biggest pet peeve fixed.
There's a caveat of that on the not well-received list, and I have four items on the not well-received list, and these are kind of the major items. Someone complained about the auto-renewal of trade routes, which is that they may not be lucrative or as lucrative on renewal as it was when first established and or most previously renewed, so you probably shouldn't auto-renew them so you can maximize your output.
Yeah, and it just says that it renews. It doesn't say that it keeps it set at that level permanently.
That's right.
Because that would be cheap and crappy.
Yeah, but when you get to the late stage of the game and you're trying to manage like 20 trade routes, you probably don't care to min-max them that much.
Well, and also some trade routes is like, I will always send this boat to my capital from this city because I want it to feed production. I don't care if it goes from 9 to 10 or 10 to 8 or whatever on any given run. It will always be sending this one and it will always do that. So yeah, auto-renew is good. You should not auto-renew, say, if you're like sending to places that are like questionable, those other people that you might be bombing from space.
Yeah, you don't want to be sending those trade routes to people you're about to board deck on.
And stations should pretty much always be auto-renew if you're planning on that one being constant.
Yes.
Because it's only going to get better.
It's only going to get better.
The other thing that people liked was the trade routes based on pop.
That was a really nice change.
Yeah, people liked it. The one thing they didn't like, which is not in the patch notes, is Hutama's, otherwise known as Palaestralia, two free trade routes in their capital count as two actual trade routes now. They are not over and above the other trade routes. So they're built in, which means that Hutama doesn't get another trade route for the capital until Pop 34.
Let's say you don't hit 34 on your capital all the time?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Two extra trade routes over and above everything else. That was a really good bonus. Now it's, well, you have access to all the trade routes that you would normally have access to at the beginning, and then that's it. The benefit of Hutama has severely dropped.
Yeah, that seems like a bug more than anything else.
Possible.
Not well received, and this kind of reflects what we talked about on episode 222. Speculated based on the details of this patch, which was primarily wonder-based. So, other than that notable item, some wonders are either still not wonderful or now not wonderful, or at least not as wonderful as they used to be. No turn 100 plus affinity quests being triggered.
Still.
Talked about that before. We kind of knew that going in, seeing as how it wasn't in the patch notes.
Wasn't on the list.
Before I get to the last item on the not well received list, in the 2K forum, Don Blass linked to two posts on Reddit from early March. So this was before this winter patch was released. Both of them were started by himself. One which was thoughts on the lack of a compelling mid-late game and low-hanging fruit for balance patches, to which Dave Hinkle responded, quote, "Those are all numerous days old, though. This thread is specifically for feedback on the changes in the latest update. Let's keep it on topic, folks. Smiley face," unquote. To which DB responds, "All right, I see. I was thinking give us feedback on things that need to be done after this update instead of give us feedback on the specific changes in this patch."
How about the stuff that you made changes to in this patch? Yes, please change them in the future.
Yeah, these things you changed, can you unchange them? Thanks.
Dave did say, "Let's use this thread as a place for feedback on some of the changes, so don't you dare provide feedback on all of the changes or that will be ignored." No, I have no idea.
Well, certain changes will just have to ignore you.
Yeah.
If you talk about that random unspecified bug fixes.
The one thing that was new to me, or raised an eyebrow, was a unlock in Beyond Earth for playing starships. And by unlock, we mean that kind of if you know how to use a text editor, the game files are already there and you can unlock it by modifying it. But essentially what it does is it adds two new colonist, two new spacecraft, and two new cargo options to starting the game. Person who noted this and replied to this thread initially was making it available as a mod where you could acquire it, but less than 24 hours later, he removed the mod. Your additional options are Pioneers, minus 50% production cost to Settler and Explorer class units, and Mercenaries, that's plus 25 city hit points, and units get the Homeland Defense promotion, which is increased strength within home borders. Spacecraft, supply module, two resource pods are spawned near your landing site, and the electromagnetic sensor, which reveals artifacts on the map. And the one that got my eyebrows raised the most, Cryotome, a free virtue, although in the text he wrote free social policy, this is not Civ 5, hee. And Xeno management, you start with an ultrasonic emitter unit. This emitter passively damages all alien units around it for 10 damage per turn. Although it doesn't say when it says all alien units around it, it doesn't specify hexes. In any event, this apparently unlocks just by playing starships. So I assume that means you purchase starships, you start the game, maybe not even actually in a game, but you just start the program. It's not quite clear. But apparently this is part of the Beyond Earth update, and there has been some negative feedback about this ability being embedded within the update.
What?
People are claiming that, look, this should just be part of the Beyond Earth patch update. I shouldn't have to go in with a text editor and make this available. Stop trying to get us to purchase starships so we could get something for Beyond Earth. Except in that entire veil, we do know that it was said before this patch ever came out, or even before starships came out, that there was going to be interconnectivity between starships and Beyond Earth. So I guess there is that example of that.
It's called, here's some free stuff for that game if you buy this game. Crush promotion's been going on forever. Shut up. Seriously.
Well,
The complainers can just be quiet.
Put a sock in it?
Yeah. I mean, you can go in and edit the XML. It's not like that's hard to do if you don't want to buy starships and play starships. So, yeah. What's the point in complaining about something that has been done forever? Cross promotion.
Yeah, I mean, I've got conflicting emotions and views on it, but I think if you're really serious about this, then either you're going to make the effort to investigate it and find a way to use a text editor to make it available, or if you don't, seeing as how it's not really documented specifically, then if you don't know that it exists, then I don't know how you're going to be missing it or upset about it.
You didn't pay for it, so shut up.
I'm already hearing the response back from that from some of the community, which would be, well, that should have been in the base game.
Too freaking bad. It wasn't.
All I'm hearing from Gretchen is boo-hoo.
Yeah, stop freaking whining. It wasn't in the base game. It was built by this other team for this other game, and they wanted to cross-promote, so they gave you some nice things. And it's not like the stuff that's in the cross-promote stuff is all that awesome anyways. I mean, there's some different things, which is nice to change things up, but it's none of them are like gameplay changing things that you absolutely need it. So seriously, get it, don't get it. You didn't pay for it, so it doesn't really matter if you have it.
And if you have not logged on to Steam in a while, then you also probably do not have this patch. So you could go ahead and start Steam. If you get the update, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to play it, of course, but it is available. People will continue to provide feedback, and maybe we'll follow up on this patch in a future episode. If and when I see some details in the community about these miscellaneous changes, this minutia that would not be reported by a general gaming site, for example, that I wouldn't say only people who play the game care about or care to know about, but we're the ones that really want to know about it because we are, well, Civ fanatics.
Well, yeah, that too. Solar collectors don't work on canyons? That's kind of annoying.
Apparently at Game Designer Conference in San Francisco, Will Miller and David McDonough were talking about how they thought Civ Beyond Earth should have been more audacious. There's a lot of feedback on the threads about that. It is currently way too long of a thread to recap in a 1 hour. But I definitely thought that it was a very solid game with a low variance. You had Terrascapes and a lot of useful farms and generators and academies to go and make all your tiles awesome. So unlike Civ 5, you ended up with a lot less reliance on what resources you rolled up near your starting territory. And I think that's part of why people didn't like that.
Yeah, the first article that we're featuring here is from Gamma Sutra, which was published on the 5th of March. That's when the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco was. On CFC, there's already more than 175 replies and 8,000 views as of this recording, where, as already read by NER, we should have been more audacious, is a quote by Will Miller, one of the co-lead designers. And on Wonders, he is quoted as saying, "We'd had a perfect opportunity to bring out the sci-fi and flavor of the game that people could integrate into their own story. But we completely missed it. Here was an opportunity to allow players to do things that you could never do in a traditional Civ, but we just held ourselves back because we were too afraid," unquote. Then Dave McDonough said in the same article, "In moving Civilization from an historical setting to a science fiction setting, we had a real opportunity to do things differently, but we were too conservative. And then on diplomacy specifically, we figured the diplomacy system would work exactly the same in BE, but because we didn't have the historical foundation for the game, that system didn't work. If we could go back, we would provide players with more fiction to hold on to. We actually wrote a lot of this material, but we held it back from the game," unquote. And indeed, you can hear more about that on episode 214, where the BE developers give their own account of the game's great mistake. And there is more information in the article and the second article, but I'm choosing just to read where Will Miller and Dave McDonough are quoted specifically, not anything that has been paraphrased by either Gamma Sutra's Simon Parkin or in the Polygon article, Dave Tack. And there wasn't as much in the Polygon article, which came out a week later, by the way. In terms of direct quotes, anyway, there's even less to talk about there as far as I'm concerned. Although, it's still got 98 replies and 4,500 views and counting as of this recording, also on CFC. The only quote that I see that does not include paraphrase for context is again on diplomacy. Dave McDonough was quoted on diplomacy in the first article, and now Miller says, "There needed to be more of a game in the diplomacy system. It just fell flat," quote unquote. I think we've reflected that before on previous episodes of the show, which is, so how often do you interact with the leaders, you know, after the initial landing where, you know, you are quote unquote forced to talk to them?
And the answer was,
talk? We talk to them? No, they're over there. They do their thing and we do our thing and stuff happens, but there's still no real lines of communication. I think I still interact more with the stations than I do with the AI proper.
Better say, an army of Xenotitans is in considered talking.
Well, it certainly sends a message.
Yeah.
So what's more important, concurrent users or
Doomgrass? Yeah, I'm looking at that and I'm going, I have this thing on Ars Technica about all the Steam popularity. It's really interesting. You have this one graph that's the most played 2014 releases on Steam, excluding the free-to-play stuff. And Civ Beyond Earth has like this horrendous ratio of how many people own it and haven't played it versus how many people have played it. More people own it and haven't played it than have actually played it. It's just
actually,
like, what?
More people own it and haven't played it than almost by a very little tiny amount Goat Simulator, which is at the number one. It's got more than Insurgency, the number of people who have not played it.
Yeah, there are more people that own and play Goat Simulator than there are people that own and haven't played Beyond Earth.
Yep.
But barely.
Barely. I know, but it just stands out on this graph because it's so unusual. I mean, yeah, some of them have a little bit of green. You expect that. Green is the color of unplayed. But yeah, but that's just like, if more than half the people own it have never bothered playing it, what?
And it's not just like a little bit.
What is it? It's
1.3 million, yeah.
Yeah, versus the 0.8 that have actually played it.
I'm wondering if it's from the free weekend. Maybe they have weird data going on with that.
I don't think it sticks in your system after a free weekend and counts as being owned.
It doesn't, but I'm not sure if their data actually correctly excludes those.
It depends on how their API gets the data, yeah.
I mean, the graph does say millions of estimated players and owners. So.
Yeah, it's all estimates, which is kind of weird because, you know, Steam would have the numbers.
Although maybe that's because they're saying estimated players and estimated time because you could be in offline mode.
Mm, true.
Yeah, yeah. So the point of when it comes down to how they collected the data, most important spot, is the fact that they used Steam APIs to grab who was playing what and what they have. Basically, they scraped public pages on the steamcommunity.com, which, if you have bought a game, will show up on there. If you've played any time, I'm pretty sure that it is also there. So, you know, it's plausible that they're getting the data. The only problem that they talked about is that they're missing both Dota 2 and Team Fortress 2, because for some reasons, Valve did not put those two games inside the Steam API.
Well, even with that, it's still in the most played games. In the top 20 of the most played games on Steam for 2014, which, considering it came out late in 2014, is pretty good.
Yeah, there's just the later chart about the highest average daily sales on Steam, and that indicates, for example, how many days the game was on the market, so you can use that number. So days on the market in 2014, and then backtrack in your mind that number to some of these charts that we've already talked about to try to put it in a more meaningful context.
Well, if you actually look on the daily sales per days on the market, so thousands of average estimated owners per day on the market. They actually did try and do that, and Civ up there at about 17,000 per day.
Yep, so that puts Beyond Earth 7th on the list.
Yeah, barely ahead of Don't Starve Together.
But there's another one on page 2 that's the most played older releases, which is 2012 or before. And guess what's number 3? Civ 5. Mer, mer, mer. That tell you, it's holding on. The two things above are one of the Counter-Strike ones and EVE Online.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Yeah, so technically it's first, right?
Well, technically
Counter-Strike's a good game.
But don't forget, there's still Dota 2 and TF2, which would both be in the 1 and 2 spot somewhere in there.
And Civ 5 would be 5th, which would be funny.
Yeah, Civ 5 is 5th. Yeah, take that. It was on purpose.
Also, how is Civ City Roam on this list?
That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, for the most played older releases. Yeah. As long as those old releases have at least 40,000 or more owners.
So for the 2014 releases, most played, mean number of hours per owner, if they have 20,000 owners.
Yeah, Civ Beyond Earth is not their man. There.
Football Manager 2015 is crazy high, though.
It's always up there for some reason.
I noticed that. Who all play it all day, every day.
Yeah.
They just leave it on 24/7. That's how you play.
Well, yeah, they just stay in the game. I've joked about that before. Let's rack up the hours that we've accumulated this game by just loading the game and walking away, going to work.
True. I'll just do that. I'll do that next week. I'll just load up Beyond Earth before I leave, and I'll artificially inflate its hours.
Sure.
There's one more chart from this that I saw that Beyond Earth was on there that I don't think we've talked about. That's the most played games on Steam released in 2014. Estimated total hours played. Beyond Earth is at 11th at 20,600,000 minutes. It's about 343,333 hours, 14,306 days, 2,044 weeks, or 39.3 years. And for a game that came out in late October 2014... Wow. People were loving to hate it or hating to love it.
And just to think, Football Manager 2015 has only got 130.4 million as comparison.
Yes, in the top spot. That's right.
It's only like 6.5 times more popular, or at least left on. I'm starting to get it with Mackie's concept that somebody turned it on January 1st and just refused to turn the game off. That's what they all just do now. Oh, wait, thousands of hours played per day on the market, days since release. Yeah, I think somebody's cheating. 1,124 hours played per day of being on the market for Football Manager. I think they're cheating.
Civilization 3 patch release, headaches ensue, is how I paraphrase this result. On the 16th of March, 2K Games announces, we're happy to announce that multiplayer has been restored to Civilization 3, Civilization 3 Conquest, and Civilization 3 Play the World. They're specifically referring to the shutdown of the GameSpy service nearing a year ago, as it was May or June of last year. Dave Hinkle, again, I mentioned before, the social and community manager for 2K, specifically for Firaxis Games, commented that the update that replaces GameSpy with Steam for multiplayer functionality is now available. The game functions identically to the previous GameSpy system, with the exception that the direct IP option has been removed as it is no longer supported.
Really?
What the...
This sounds familiar. Where have I heard this before?
Yeah. Didn't we go through this last year?
Really?
Episode 204 in Polycast, where we, quote, taking Civilization 4 publisher 2K Games to task over the removal, albeit with prompt reversal, of direct IP and Pit Boss multiplayer capabilities for Steam-based versions of the game last June. History is repeating itself. Wow. So, feedback. Where's my direct IP?
Feedback. Can you hear the gesture I'm making?
Some people reported, I can't even load the game. But if you can load the game, then you may not be able to start a single-player game. You may not be able to load previous saves, even though, again quoting from Dave Hinkle, save game data should not be negatively affected, unquote. So he did say should not. He did not say will not. Other feedback includes removal of windowed mode and animations not working properly. So hopefully there will be a swift reversal of this, but I was kind of surprised that it had been removed. Just because it's no longer supported, then fine, you make it clear that it is no longer supported. So if people have difficulty with that, then you're not going to provide support. But removing it, especially after what we went through less than a year ago, I'm kind of flabbergasted by that, more than the fact that there was a Civilization 3 patch release. That was good, you know, that they're trying to provide support with the older game. But this is one of those one-step-forward, two-step-backward things that we just have to facepalm over.
Yeah, it's just kind of annoyingly facepalmy when they've already gone through this once and then the community said, hey, dummy, so that you turn around and do it again. Like, it's the same process. Removing GameSpy, adding Steam. Why you know do things properly the second time?
Oh, and if you own a physical disc version of Civilization 3 and are interested in receiving this multiplayer update, please submit a support request. So I love that. If for some reason you want this, then you submit a support request. I don't know. Please hit me over the head. Well, we will be glad to do so, sir. We will take your request in priority sequence.
Yeah, I don't know. There's not a lot good to say about this. It's just an eyebrow raiser. Like, really, that's all I have to say is that. Just really.
Facepalm pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
Raising the Civilization community's ire is important to us.
At least you've got a reaction. It means you still care, right? Right?
On the Cifanetics forum, Mega Bears fan talked about how frustrated he was with trying to move the carpet of doom in Civilization 5. Unlike most people on the internet, however, he provided a possible solution with the move column feature that they would add.
What? He provided a solution to his problem on the internet?
I'm pretty certain you're just supposed to complain full stop.
Wait,
I don't know about this.
Wait, just scroll down a few posts. I'm sure someone will say why it won't work.
Actually, that's post 2. It didn't last too long.
Yeah, so what is this column marching thing anyway?
From what it looks like, you just add all of your units to a data structure of a column, and they would just all move in a row, and you just select the column and you just say move to this tile, and it will just have everyone move in a column manner.
Sounds like an army.
Yeah, it's almost like it is.
Could also create a group rather than an individual column. So take all of the units within this space and say, all of you, go left. Would that work too?
Well, you see so. I mean, with the column marching, you could have, regardless of the unit type, treat them all as one big army. Or then you could say, okay, with units that are siege, you are now this particular army, and then you could move them and those that are melee and then those that are ranged. You could get into multiple combinations here.
I don't like the stacking.
Do more with less. You don't need to stack.
Yeah, Mega Bears fan does say it doesn't have to be any limit to the size of the stack. He clarifies in a later post. Maintenance costs, general unit cap, and the inability to attack if you can't deploy the stack would help control the stack size. So I think that also gets to, this isn't something you would automatically do or the game would necessarily automatically do for you, but it's a choice you would have to make, because one of the things that he does say, if you are moving in this column formation, they have an inability to attack. So he's suggesting move them as a group, but then if you want to attack, then you have to decouple them and have them be individual units again.
Yeah, it's basically just a way of trying to get a lot of units across the map faster.
And I think a lot of the times when you're going to be able to move units across the map, and he does acknowledge that zone of control still exists, so most of the time I don't think it's going to be a particular issue that they would be vulnerable to attack, because when I think of units that I am moving, at least over great distances, would be through my territory or through neutral territory trying to get myself to the front.
Bombers. Nukes.
Before such a time as units are available, which would be the majority of the game, unless you're one of these advanced starts people.
Frigates, other ranged units. There's lots of things that can hit things from a distance.
Couldn't you just use column move with like a click drag thing?
Yeah, I'd almost say just like do box select and just tell it to go somewhere and have
that's
it stay
what I'm
in that formation.
Too.
Yeah, in that formation, and the things on the edge of the side that you're going towards, i.e. if you're going left, then the units on the left side move first, then it moves in based on as it goes column by column inward without actually creating stacks. That's possible to actually get done, but it has issues like if you run into a mountain, then you have...
Yeah, I mean, it would probably just block you from moving, but it would still save some time. It's not like perfect, but it would help.
Yeah, you people go that way. Okay.
And moving the carpets of doom so that you could have all, say, three hexes in a row, and then you could move them together as a group. And then if there was this situation where, you know, in three turns, this leftmost column is going to run into a mountain, then fine, then maybe in that situation, you could either have it so that the user is prompted to make that change, or if people don't want to deal with that micromanagement, then it could be maybe something automated where it says give priority to X type of units, for example, to move first.
All your units die because you ran them into the mountain without moving them.
It's not realistic to get a good automated priority system there. I would much prefer just to get prompted, lest we go back to that Civ 4 crap where the Civ ships would like reroute automatically because something happened to block them in the fog of war. No thanks.
Oh, I agree. I would rather the prompt. But there are people that will complain, too many decisions. Fine. Then you let it automate, you know, to at your peril.
It's still better than now, even if you have a prompt.
No, it's the thing. It's like, oh, there's something in the fog. I can't go that way. Well, technically, I don't know there's something in the fog. If there is, I want you to go forward and shoot that thing in the fog.
don't attack
around.
The fog. For God's sake, just if you're going to run into a unit in the fog, stop the unit before it does anything to said unit in the fog one way or another. Just stop it. It didn't use that movement yet.
Yeah, just stop one beforehand or when it gets seen. You know, when it gets seen is a good one.
That's different fine, sight too. Ranges. That's better.
Sight ranges are questionable sometimes.
Yeah, you want it to have the squirrel.
Go that way.
Response.
I love it.
A couple of other things from the thread. One, Mega Bears fan also does ask, I actually guess it's a little later on, can civilian units be stacked? He says, if so, I would suggest that they cannot perform actions while stacked.
No.
Yeah, you could stack them. Maybe they can't perform actions.
So you make like a 50 stack of settlers and then put like one archer on it. Look at us go! And I'll just like send you over there to plant that city, and I'll send you over there to plant that city as we march across the planet. That seems to defeat the concept of the game.
To go with that, MegaBears fan is asked and says that yes, there's implied collateral damage. The damage could be dealt equal for all units in the stack as opposed to, oh, if this unit is in the stack, then therefore it's going to take all of the damage first before it goes on to another unit in the stack.
Yeah, I know. I'm more impressed with his one technical question to consideration to overcome in the fourth post. How to handle a situation in which all tiles are filled with stacks of units such that none can move or attack each other. So you go from one unit per turn having all tiles being filled by a single units that can do stuff to stacks on every single tile where they can't deploy or do anything else. I think if you have that many units going on, probably doing something really wrong.
Yeah, it's probably at your peril with, in part, like this thing called the maintenance cost.
No, I'm thinking more like CPU probably did something a while ago.
Yes.
You mean technical, not so much gameplay. Technical.
Speaking of which, when you change the rules on unit movement like that, the AI has to be set to handle that. Whereas if you're just talking about selecting a group of units and moving them, that's not necessarily going to house the problem for the AI's turns and movement.
Actually, it might improve it.
If it can be taught to use it, great. But I guess my point is, if you're allowing unit stacking, you're going to wind up with situations where the AI is inefficiently stacking units or causing itself other problems. Can probably be abused at war.
Like the AI constantly throwing its units in the water?
Things made even worse. If you create some sort of limitation when units are stacked but allow the AI to stack, it will be quite difficult to prevent situations where the player deliberately stacks up AI units.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I like to herd them all into one location, and okay, I'm going to deal damage equally to all of you because you're all in one spot.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have the limit that I do.
Hey, you just funneled through this pass, and six artillery are firing on like 10 units in one spot over and over. Man, that experience.
Yep.
I don't think that's a good route. I mean, if you can program the AI for it, great, but this is probably a next game thing at that point.
Oh, definitely. This would be a next game sort of a thing.
Whereas, like, a box selected movement could probably have been done in either Civ 5 or Beyond Earth.
Yeah, that's plausible options. I don't know, just the whole constantly going to stack. Let's stack stuff. I find that more questionable than anything else. Though, in this same thread, somewhere along the way, there was a discussion about being able to use harbors as transports. As in, harbors can airlift stuff between harbored cities earlier in the game than when you actually have planes. You could probably even use it as a transport, quote-unquote, trade unit, whereas if you are going across the water, then the trade unit can make a circuit, goes to the other city, and then when it makes it there, you get the unit. That actually could work. Saves you from tossing it in the water and slow-poking across
the
water.
So they sort of disappear for a short period of time while they're being transported?
Yeah, they become a trade unit, which can be intercepted and killed. You're transporting the pieces of the units, kind of like they have to get tanks to someplace somewhere. It's not like you can turn around and start using the tank right away. They sort of take it all apart and put it back together later.
This is about reimagining history, not
realism. Oh my gosh.
How dare you use realism argument?
Oh my gosh.
Ermengarde.
I couldn't resist this role.
If you already have astronomy and all the water-based things, maybe not harbors. Maybe seaports, actually. That would do it. Because then that would come at navigation. And you would need a seaport so that the seaport would actually do something more useful than the harbor. Because the harbor already has the city connections. Uh-huh. And it would especially work in Beyond Earth, because Beyond Earth doesn't have any increase in water movement.
Well, we could just have the increase in water movement that we have in Civilization 5. More path of least resistance to address that issue. But, you know, I still hear what you're saying. Recorded for episode 222 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, Mad Jin, and Lord Tyrion. All 43 civilizations ranked against each other, data collected from a survey of over 300 Civ Redditors. Although you do not have to be a registered user of Reddit, and technically you don't even have to read this thread on Reddit if someone else sent you the link to the survey. But anyway, this is where it is being discussed. Trying to figure out what people think is the best civilization for going this particular way. What's the best one to go tall versus wide? What's their strengths and weaknesses? How easy is it to maintain happiness of this civilization as opposed to the other? The survey itself really wants you to choose the three civilizations that you play most often as. It's question one. Then you want to rank each civ in order from the best to the worst, except that's an optional question, so you can ignore it. Question three is which civs are best for each victory condition. Not every civ needs an answer, and in fact, you don't have to answer anyway. You can just click the next button. There isn't even a required response there. What civilizations play best in tall or wide? You can also not answer that, the way the survey is constructed as of this recording. What strengths do each civilization specialize in? At least five answers are needed, and you do have to provide five, no more, no less. What era do you think the well-performing civs peak in? And, of course, that also depends on what you think is a well-performing civ. But anyway, it says not every civ needs an answer, as some may not peak, but you can just answer one civilization. Which civ do you hate the most?
Can be based on leader just for fun, but you don't have to answer that question either. Just like for question 8 and question 9, which is which civ is the least difficult to play as and which civ is the easiest to sustain happiness, you can answer none as well. So as much as I have questions about the data, I have even more questions about how the data is collected. Although I like the idea of trying to put this together, even if this is not so much strategy as it is player preferences and player perceptions, for better or worse. This was started by Lasagna's Meg. Bragor did say in the comments, next survey could always differentiate between single player and multiplayer. And Lasagna Meg says, I find this was the biggest mistake in collecting this data. I don't agree with that. That was the biggest mistake. But I have some issues, as I already read over. So I still feel it's relevant information for most players, but for most people who seriously devote themselves to specific single-player or multiplayer strategies might argue with a lot of the rankings. I think it's a bit of, again, your preferences. I don't think it's relevant to most players. I think it's of interest to a lot of players to see, what do I think about each of these civilizations and how do I play these civilizations if I play them at all? Because if you are going to rank who you think is the best performing civ and then it's not one of the civilizations you play the most as, then you could question an individual response, which is, well, is that really your opinion or is that just the opinion you've got from other people you played with or did you just randomize your answer? There's also 5 images. I think actually the more interesting part of it is where he takes all of the data in the charts and the pie graphs and then talks about each individual civilization. And so then just in one image, you can pay attention to one particular civ. I think he's done it for about 8 of the 43 right now. We're making you aware of this because you may find some of the data collection interesting and some of the conclusions that are reached interesting that could very well influence the next civilization you play and how you treat the civilizations you play against.
Sure, but then I'm looking at some of this data and my strength ratings and most significant strength and seeing America, England, Germany, and Ottomans all in domination late game, except that the Ottomans' unique units all pop up mid game, even though Denmark is considered a domination rush, and so is Japan, and so is China, all of which have techs right before the Ottomans, and then England is considered a late game domination, even though their longbows are at the same place as China. Not entirely sure if some of these are accurate.
I like the most hated civ. That looks fun.
The most hated civ leader? Greece?
Yeah.
Way off the chart?
Yeah. I do find that amusing.
It's probably true, though.
Yeah.
I think if you do enough of these, you will find a lot of people hate Greece.
Yeah. And not surprisingly, people find Babylon the easiest and then Poland. Well.
Yeah, Poland's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And yes, he does also provide in a chart the top 10, and even across the 43, he's kind of broken them up into tiers. Although when you look at that and the top 10 and even the bottom 10, if you look at the numerical value beside the ranking, there are some ties. For example, in the top 10, Arabia is 5th and Maya are the 6th, except for the number that's shown there, it's the same, but they don't share the 5th ranking. So until you start delving into the rest of the data, maybe the rest of the data actually explains why that is, but at a glance, it raised an eyebrow. So again, I like the idea of this, but the way that the data in particular was collected is also going to have an impact on the information that you present and how you present that information.
And then I would guess actually, just as a backwards caveat to the most hated civ leader when the AI is playing it versus a player playing it. Because, AI grease is a pain in the ass, but player grease is not.
Unless you random personalities, then we get all thrown out the window. I just had to say that. Hee hee.
Yes.
Does Miasma have a point?
Miasma does have a point. It kills off all of Mad Jin's workers on his live streams.
We had to work for that. Took effort to get that going.
This thread was actually started by someone who was a guest on episode 209 of the show.
Yo-Yo.
Yeah.
He thinks it's a minor annoyance. If you go Harmony, then after a lot of tech and other stuff and affinity levels, you get some healing in it and other people are still taking damage in it. So it's a little bit of minor annoyance health-wise, especially because everybody can get all those techs that boost up healing. So eventually if you take 10, but you heal, you get plus 10 or more. Or you can just go get that tech that's out there that says miasma doesn't do any damage to you at all. There's that one, which kind of makes it totally useless. And of course, for purity and supremacy, miasma is just that thing that you throw up the miasmic repulsor to get rid of as quickly as possible because it's just annoying. So other than the fact that it's a minor annoyance, does it have a point?
You can throw up miasma condensers on your opponent's territory to take up their orbital slots and also just to troll all their units.
Yeah. But that's not really the miasma that's necessary.
I think its most damaging and significant timing is early game when you spawn near it, because you can't do a lot with those hexes. You can, but it slows you down so much. It's like spawning near jungle or something in previous games where jungle has a long time to make improvements and you don't get any hammers when you chop it. Like, when you have that kind of situation, expanding in that direction is discouraged heavily. Hmm. So it does have that impact. It's harder terrain to get any usage out of early.
Yeah, although nowadays you can just have your worker clear the miasma.
That still takes time, though, and you either then need more workers or your improvements come online more slowly. It's a significant cost, no matter how you slice it.
Especially trade routes. Trade routes are heavily affected by miasma.
Jeez, yeah. And there, too, you want those up early if you can get them going.
Yeah. Well, if you have them, you want to be able to use them because you only get so many of them now. Especially early game, the new patch, you get very, very few of them for quite some time. So, yeah, miasma gets involved in the trade side. But I think the generalized point is that miasma is in the game. It has some minimal effect, but it doesn't fit within the affinity split quite as well as it could. So, you know, Harmony plus Miasma could mean economic Harmony, where you want to spam Miasma all over the place because you would gain some economic bonus out of it. So say you get something per tile that you work, or, you know, the amount of Miasma around your city gives you some bonus to the city itself.
Could either just make it more damaging or harder to ignore, too. In other words, make it much more difficult for the non-Harmony players to get through it.
Yeah, there's that, too. Harmony.
And there's a lot you can do with it.
Crazy Miasma.
Oh yeah, you can buff your miasma as Harmony. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, there you can go for the double Harmony and then spawn nests. Harmony players could spawn nests in places that have lots of miasma.
The question, does miasma have a point? The answer to me is yes. So it's not really a question of yes or no, miasma has a point or doesn't have a point. It's just that, and we're kind of getting that already, is the point that it's making a good one. Could it be better? Should it be better? And I think it should. Like when Hobbs Yo-Yo says towards the end, whether or not I clear up miasma is a totally a chance decision by myself. And to me, I wouldn't say chance decision. It's a choice. Am I going to take the time? For instance, I typically go purity. Miasma is an obstacle. So the question is, like Phil said, am I going to invest the time in doing something with it? Because I think the time that I invest right now is going to pay dividends afterwards and put me in a better position. Or am I just going to ignore it? So when Hobbs Yo-Yo then says, its effect on my strategy is almost non-existent in that way, even if you don't embrace miasma because you're not a Harmony player, it has had an effect on your strategy so much early on in the game that that just snowball effects for better or worse as the turns go on.
Although something I did get pointed out is Terrascapes can't be built on tiles with miasma. So purity does have a adjustment. The funny thing is you can clear the miasma, build the Terrascape, and then put the miasma back on it.
Oh, jeez.
I would suggest that's not shouldn't be possible, that miasma versus Terrascape.
Speaking of exploits
burn one way or the other. But no, I think the general mechanic, Harmony should get some sort of benefit to having lots of miasma around. Purity would want to get rid of it. Purity should get, if you have more farms and more manufactories, then you would want to get rid of miasma. And maybe Supremacy just wouldn't care because you're all going robots, so it really doesn't matter if the planet's gassed or not.
Maybe reduce the yields on tiles for purity if they have miasma on it or something.
Yeah, that would be also awesome. Reduced yields if it has miasma for both purity and supremacy. So you would want to remove it, although you're going to do it anyways. But it could be economic, like Harmony would get at least equal or proper or maybe even more from tiles with miasma on it, and purity players would lose it.
Yeah, just nothing on Xenomass wells, because those things have enough yield already.
Yeah, the actual wells themselves are good enough. But that's the thing. That's why you would think that Harmony would get a yield-based economic boost, because when you look at the different strategics, Xenomass gets the most yield-based boost of the three, but then Harmony also does not get much of anything else. It's like Purity and Supremacy have far more science buildings and more powerful science buildings, and they have better units. It could be made to be more interesting.
Yeah.
The general point.
Absolutely.
Now with Harmony 1 giving no damage to explorers with Miasma, it's starting to get more questionable about why Miasma's in the game, but yeah.
Ooh, you could have enough of a concentration of Miasma as the game goes on if you don't clear it out, then a new alien nest appears even more frequently, or just starts spawning units at random if you leave it alone. Let it grow wild, untamed.
Yeah, then the concentration would create new Xenomass on the map.
There you go.
Or just start spawning siege worms everywhere.
Yes.
I think that's the ideal solution, because everyone likes those things.
Siege worms for everybody!
You get a siege worm, and you get a siege worm!
There must be at least 15 worms on the map at all times. Every time you kill one, another one just appears to make sure that the 15 siege worm quota is there. You can have more, but you can never have less.
Oh, no. When you kill one, two more appear.
Oh, there you go.
Get rid of those two.
So it's
and
like
they have a special ability. They're the only unit in the game that can ignore stacking limitation. Mmm, chocolate.
Talking about step 5 here.
So this thread started by Pluto 101. Plantations on cocoa equals less food? The answer is yes, because you're removing jungle. So in jungle, cocoa plus 3 food plus 1 gold, banana plus 3 food. With a plantation, cocoa plus 1 food plus 1 production plus 2 gold, or bananas plus 1 food plus 1 production. So yes, plantations aren't adding food in this case.
No, it's adding a gold.
It will add a food at fertilizer.
Yes.
And not just to cocoa.
Yeah, that's to any plantation, yeah. And the general thing is, yes, because jungles give you 2 food, they replace the ground, not add to it. So yeah, jungles are 2, usually on plains, so 2 food becomes 1 food, 1 production. And then in the cocoa's case, the plantation gives gold, whereas in banana's case, it gives food.
When I was your age, jungles didn't even give food.
Take that. I remember back in Civ 3, you burned every single jungle down.
Yeah, Civ 4 too. Civ 5 is the first time you get anything from jungle.
It's
like, wait, useful jungle? What is this? You kids these days have it so easy.
Oh, speaking of you kids these days, somebody actually said somewhere in this thread, I kid you not, Lord Balkoth, 2 food greater than 2 science with respect to don't improve bananas. Yeah.
No.
We're just like, what?
At what stage of the game are we talking about here? Because it's hard for me to think of one, but...
It was in responses like, seems like plantations aren't adding the food. Of course not, because especially on bananas, you're losing the 2 food, blah, blah, blah. Plantations don't give food bonus until fertilizer, just 1 extra gold. The reference is to Dr. Vic Tim, 4 bananas don't improve them. And somebody said, 2 food greater than 2 science. Because normally you don't improve them so that you get the 2 science from the...
No, I get that. Diversity. I was trying to think about the situations where you'd prefer the food to the science, and that's...
That'd be like post-fertilizer. Yeah. And by that point, you've already done a lot. Of course, they do say, or ideally, plant a great scientist on the banana and get 3 food, 1 production, 8 science, or something like that.
The other thing is, like, leaving the jungle means you don't have to improve the tile, whereas...
It also takes a long time.
Yeah, which takes a long time. So that's not an insignificant consideration on its own.
And again, the granary boosts the banana, regardless of it has a plantation. And if you went Sun God, it boosts the banana, regardless of if you improve it.
Yeah.
So you have to question if it's a plantation-based increase, because there are a number of those. The plus culture from plantations and stuff like that. But you have to choose between plantation-based stuff or just the resource-based stuff. And generally, you want to keep the resource-based stuff with jungles, because plantations suck in comparison to the jungle. Until late in the game when you get all the boosts, of course. Seriously, don't improve bananas. I can see sometimes you would want to improve the banana if the banana's on a hill and you're in the middle of jungles.
Because you really, 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 really need that production.
Yeah, it's more about the production at that point than the food. But at least you still get a bit of food because of the banana.
Ogun M is asking me an army encirclement because he says, the other day as he was playing the Huns, he noticed the Persians inching an army towards me. As their spy just had uncovered they were plotting a sneak attack against me. Yeah, very sneaky. The 10 units in clear sight, it's really sneaky. They marched toward the capital, kind of nestled themselves between their three cities, and just for a giggle, they decided to buy all the tiles around their units in order to trap them. So what he wanted to ask the forums is, against the AI, is army encirclement a valid tactic? Don't we do this all the time in multiplayer when we're on our co-op game? Especially since they can't call us on having units up against their borders.
Yeah, and we've also done things like just send your army out to circle their army. And then they can't go anywhere. And if they never make it to the launching point, they can't attack you.
Surrounded pound.
Group hug.
Yep. Done that to settlers.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think it's considered a valid tactic. I mean, what he's asking about, though, he bought all the tiles around his units so that they couldn't go anywhere. But eventually, that tactic gets defeated by your city's auto-buying the tiles that those units
are. Yeah, and then it'll pop them back out of the borders.
Yeah. Or the AI's like, you know what? I don't mind being here, and attacks you anyways from that spot.
Yeah.
You plays into my clever clan, stupid human.
Therefore, the border buying was, well, not as useful as it could have been.
Unit blocking is good times, though.
Yep.
Typically, when I think of buying tiles to block AI units, it's because, oh, you think you're going to move that settler by my city and, you know, go in behind my empire. No.
You want open borders for what?
No.
No. Consentient asks, do you mean valid in the sense of frowned on or not, or in the sense of good use of your units? I think it's frowned on if you find your own army encircled, and that was a bad use of your units, to allow yourself to get... Can I rephrase the question?
It's great when we do it, and we hate it when the AI does it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the AI does it, so we can do it too. It's not like, oh, it's only something a human can do because the AI doesn't understand enough.
True. Well, the AI wouldn't understand to buy all the tiles necessarily, but...
I've seen the AI buy, or at least culture border tiles to lock your scouts in.
Yeah, it's happened to me way too much. AI just happens to get the only way by their territory, and my guys are stuck there forever.
Yep.
Especially since they don't actually get the war until they show up in my territory.
I mean, if they've blocked you from being able to go on by land, then I know it can be annoying, but I guess it's like, if it's really that important, it's like, well, I guess I want to get myself some optics, and I need to use the units back, so I, you know, just go on the water, go around them.
They need to enter your territory first, though, to get all the benefits of being able to go on water.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, like I said, you have to use units back to your territory, but if it's that important to you, and you realize you've been blocked, and you don't have optics yet, then it's like, well, I got to move the units back anyway before... I got to get optics first, so I might as well take the time, or if it's really that important, then you're like, no, I'm not going to worry about sending these units there. I'll just leave those units there on the border. We can have this demilitarized zone sort of things, and I'll just construct other units, and I'll just go on the water, and I'll just go around it and say, ha, declare war, land. Or, and there's neutral territory on the other side, land there, and be like, nice try.
I should just delete the units. Bye, Mr. Scout. Thank you for your kind service. Now go home. Oh, wait, you can't.
Well, sometimes, yeah, I might delete it. I always like those situations where this is the only tile that it can be in because it's completely surrounded by AI. And I guess you could say if you really wanted that unit moved, you could try to get open borders, say, hey, I'll give you, X gold per turn to get the unit out of there if that's critical. But more likely, I'd just be like, okay, you know what? It's going to stay in there until the cultural borders, either because they expand or they buy it. I'm just going to use it as a spy within your territory to see what's going on. And then if it's later enough in the game that I don't have to worry about having maybe a spy in that nearby city, I don't have to devote a spy to that. I can have that unit be that spy, and then I'll just wait for it to get ejected, maybe halfway across the map. It's exciting. Though in that extreme situation, I'd say it'd be more likely than not that, yes, I would go ahead and disband it, because unless I was thinking about attacking that AI right away, do I really want to spend the maintenance cost on that unit? For maybe it'll see something of significance if I remember to go and look on that turn to see if it has something interesting to show me.
The Marshmallow Bear started a discussion on how he thought it was time for him to move on after 1,400 hours of playing Civ 5.
Exactly. That is the number where you have to stop. If you do not have exactly 1,402 hours, either because you're missing a few or you went over, then you may not stop.
I'm pretty sure the number that you're allowed to move on from is 1,337.
Nope.
Nerd.
Yes. And the Marshmallow Bear does say, and there are other strategy games out there.
What?
Other 4X strategy games out there. I know, heresy.
Fire.
But he does say, Civ 5 bores me now. I could go up and do Beyond Prince, but I don't like the feeling of frustration and careful manipulation of my moves so I can just win.
Wait, what?
that's a choice that you've made. Yeah. You are bored because there's nothing more for you to do on Prince. So make the choice. Civ 5 bores you because you're still playing on Prince. But that was a choice you made. I'm not saying that's a blame, but again, that's a choice. If you don't want to go above Prince, you don't want to go into King on Beyond because you feel that it's just not worth the time, then yes, it is time for you to move on. But he also asks in general, are you guys ready to move on? I'm ready to jump ship, to be honest. And I'm thinking, well, you can't jump ship to Civilization VI because there is no Civilization VI. So it's either you stop playing games altogether, yikes, find another game to play with full stop, or play another game, or maybe honestly no games at all for a period of time, and come back.
Yep, it's not that complicated. Like, you find something you enjoy playing, you play that game, and it's nothing and you still want to play games, and you look at stuff until you find something you enjoy playing. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
But I would, if someone doesn't want to put the effort into getting better at a game, if that's not fun, then the better alternative, if you're bored with it, then is to move on, most likely. That way you're not just getting frustrated all the time.
Yeah. Well, he does have a good point, though, is that there's not many or very few at all total conversion mods out there, unlike in Civ 4.
Yeah.
That is a bit of a problem.
Well, there's enough comprehensive mods short of total,
yeah,
including some mods that are just compilations of other mods. Because if you start mixing and matching certain mods, they may not be compatible.
Yeah.
But if you go for some of the larger ones, short of total conversion one, that change this, that, and the other thing that you know will all work together, then you can go ahead and do that. And unlike Civilization 4, to me, it's easier to be loading and unloading mods into your game as well. I think that also came up in the thread as well. Other than, yes, like you said, he mentioned about total conversion mods. But you don't have to get a total conversion mod to start experiencing modding. Because I got the impression that he hadn't tried any mods yet. But if you're looking for total conversion mod and then you reject modding altogether, then to me, maybe you're not that interested in modding to begin with.
Yeah, maybe he just wanted something that totally converted it to still use the same engine but did something different. Maybe that's what he was looking for.
Yep.
May we suggest Civilization Beyond Earth? It uses the same engine.
He heard it here first.
Shots fired back.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. This has been Polycast episode 224. I'm Dan Q. Polycast is the most played of all Civilization podcasts released in 2014. Ha! Joined by Makalua.
Dan, it's the only Civilization podcast, so that wasn't too difficult.
There is also Modcast and Turncast. Mackie? Ha! The me and team.
Man, that harbor shipping thing, I've got a whole new kind of palette swap for you guys.
What?
The fact that you expend brain power trying to make sense of that, it means Phil wins, clearly. At Jin.
Right, Cuffy round two, because what?
Yeah, what?
Only round two, huh? And our first-time guest co-host, New Earth Relic.
I improve all my bananas.
Sure. I approve of your improvement of all the bananas.
What's wrong with my pronunciation of Dota? Dino in the chat. That moment when Edgen doesn't know how to say Dota. What?
I don't think you said Dota every time. Like, you said something different than Dota. If I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that time when Edgen...
Duda?
Cholololol.
And yes, we did start talking about Civilization 5, not a Civilization 5 mod for Beyond Earth.
Yeah,
we decided to
no
add
bananas on
Cocoa the island. And bananas have been brought with you.
Excuse you, that Xeno Cocoa.
We went jungle. Purity, Mackie.
What?
Wow.
Thought that was a quest. You have Cocoa and bananas showing up, and you need to go and deal something with them.
Yeah, sadly, that isn't a quest that goes anywhere beyond that question. You brought an invasive species. Great! I'm going purity. This is awesome. Yeah, that was exactly what you did. You let it go, but nothing happens.
Why improve a banana when a banana is fine just the way it is? I mean, really.
Not like you can make them plantains.
Yeah, speaking of plantaining our conversation, I pushed that through.
You gave it a hearty shove.
I am so not touching this next topic.
So, Nihar, would you agree to come back on the show?
If you guys would have me, I'd love to.
Okay, you know, just to be safe, we don't ask that question while we're still streaming live.
Three people, I'm out of here.
God, this was awful. How do you guys do this every other week?
Record date?
March 21st, 2015.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.